Welcome to Quick Brain, bite-sized brain hacks for busy people who want to learn faster and achieve more. I'm your coach, Jim Quick.
Free your mind.
Let's imagine if we could access 100% of our brain's capacity.
I wasn't high, wasn't wired, just clear. I knew what I needed to do and how to do it.
I know Kung Fu.
Show me.
Welcome back, Quick Brains. I'm your host and your brain coach, Jim Quick. To forget is to be human, yet forgetting is one of the most puzzling and sometimes frustrating aspects of the human experience. So it's natural to ask, why do we remember some events and things and forget others? We tend to believe that we can somehow should remember anything we want, but the reality is that we are designed actually to forget. And so our guest today is Sharan Rangana. He is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at the University of California at Davis. For over 25 years, he has studied the mechanisms in the brain that allow us to remember past events. He is also the author of the brand new book, Why We Remember: Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
Yeah, so I've been really looking forward to this. Really enjoyed your book. I highly recommend that our community gets their copy and gets two copies. So we say get one for yourself and then one to gift. But what we're going to talk today, everybody, is we'll be discussing why we forget things and remember things and what we could do to remember things better. So I want to jump into this. According to your book, memories are less useful for remembering the past and more useful for predicting the future. Maybe we could start there and you could elaborate on that idea.
Yeah. I think, first of all, I think it's your book and mine are probably a great companion package because I think your book is all about how to remember the things that you need. And my book is basically saying that memory is about carrying the things you need and not everything. And I think this is big misconception people have is that we should be able to replay the entire past exactly as it happened. And really, our brains are designed to carry the most important, biologically important, and the most meaningful information and to be able to deploy it really rapidly. So episodic memory, which is what I study in particular, is very important because it's about the present and the future, really. So you and I were talking just before we started recording about our various air travel things as part of our lifestyle. And you probably have this experience waking up in a random hotel room at some point and just asking yourself, where am I? Right?
which is kind of embarrassing for a memory coach or a memory expert like yourself.
But, you know, but the thing is that you snap out of it very quickly.
Yeah.
And you can say to yourself, okay, well, here I am. I'm in London today, or I'm in Singapore today, or wherever it is you happen to be. And that's based on memory. That ability to remember is keeping you grounded in time. And then what happens is, okay, you're up for a little while, you're jet lagged. And so you start to think, okay, what am I going to do today? You use memory to fill in those blanks and plug in the schedule for today. And so these are just super simple examples, right? But now I'll give you just an example from my own life about a big life choice I made, which was I finished grad school. I was choosing between going into clinical psychology or going into research. I had an internship offer that could have given me a very lucrative career clinically. And I asked myself, well, what do I enjoy the most, clinical work or research? And I started to ask myself, okay, well, what are the contexts? What are some past events that I could think of from my recent work in the clinic? And it brought back a lot of memories of having to be dressed up, being sleepy because I was there early in the morning, being, you know, thinking about and worrying about my patients and so forth. And then I brought back memories of my last times in lab and thinking about staying up late, hanging out with these guys and eating pizza and putting together posters for a conference. And I was like, well, that's the environment for me. It's not for everyone, but it was for me. And so it was just an act of mental time travel, so to speak, that allowed me to pull up all these instances and say, what's the context that makes me happiest? And I think this is the power of memory for these small decisions and the big decisions to keep us grounded in space and time and give us potential from our past.
You use the word decisions, and I think people underestimate how important the role of memory has in making our choices. There's a quote in my book, Limitless, from a French philosopher that says, life is the letter C between the letters B and D, where B stands for birth and D is death. Life C is choice. That these difficult times, they could distract us. These difficult times, they could diminish us. Or these difficult times, they could develop us. We ultimately decide. But in order to make good choices, it's based on the scheme, the body of wisdom that we've accumulated up to this point, or experiences. That means, you know, that presumes people remember it if they learned it, right? What role have you found that memory plays in us making wise choices or decisions?
Well, at the beginning of my book, I quoted Danny Kahneman's research. And so Kahneman makes this really beautiful distinction between what he called the experiencing self and the remembering self. And so just as an example, you go on a vacation and let's say you have kids or something like that. And going on vacation with kids is stressful. It's so stressful. You sit around and you like are standing in line at airport security. You're like packing these giant bags, standing in the rental car line. There's just so much lines, traffic, hassles. But then you make the next choice of, okay, what am I going to do this winter? And you go, well, let's take a vacation with the family. Because what you remember, the remembering self, is different from that experiencing self. And so yes, the experiencing self suffered from all these negative things, but the remembering self carries forward these great memories of sitting with your kid at the beach, or, you know, being able to go to this nice dinner and look, watch the sunset over the ocean. And so he argued that the remembering self is what makes those choices. And to Danny, that's irrational and not necessarily a good thing. But to me, in a mindful sense, that's a very good thing, because that's all we have from our experiences is the memory that we carry from, right? And so one way of thinking about it is that, yes, our remembering self makes the choices, and we can make the choices that will give us the best memories, right? Memory can also give us options. So memory can tell us, hey, I'm not feeling like, you know, stressed out now, but I know when I give a talk in front of a big audience, I'm going to be stressed out. So what can I do about this? And I can prepare. And so if you allow yourself to bring back experiences that don't match up where you have now, again, memory can give you more options and allow you to work around these things. I think where we get some get stuck is memory creeps into our decisions and we don't realize it, right? And so that's what I really try to say in my book is that memory is a resource. It's the perfect co-pilot, but you don't want it in the driver's seat.
It's interesting that memory is not taught in school. Right. In at least in American education system, they teach you 3 R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. Obviously, spelling is not one of them. Mm-hmm. But there was no class called retention or recall. And it's interesting in school when working with students, everything from pulling all-nighters. Right. And we could talk about the efficacy of that, because I think a lot of people don't study to remember so much as they do cram to eventually just forget the next morning, where they don't study and they just pull an all-nighter, and the next morning nobody could talk to them at breakfast because they don't want anything spilling out of their mind. But then they fall victim to that forgetting curve where upwards of 80% is forgotten within 48 hours. Or even whether it's all-nighters or even 7 a.m. classes for some of these kids, their brains are still developing, might not necessarily be the sweet spot for people to learn.
Yeah, I 100% agree. These are all factors. And you mentioned sleep. And just as to build on to that, I think cramming and doing an all-nighter has so many bad effects. So one is that your memory then when you're tested will actually can be kind of better if you cram right before the test, because the memories are glued to a place in time. And so if you're in a nearby place in time, you can access that memory easier. But now you're a week later and you've still got this memory for this experience is glued to that place and that time, and you can't access it as easily. But if you actually space out your study sessions, now that memory, every time you retrieve it in a new place and a new time, you actually unglue it from any one context and you can access it from anywhere. And I think that's where that effort comes in. But then cramming's even worse, because during sleep, your brain is actually working, and it's working to make sense of your day's experiences. And I'm very compelled by a few different studies that have shown that it's not about just stabilizing the memories of the day, but trying to make sense of them and derive meaning from them. So it's like taking the information that you've just tried to memorize and incorporating it within the space of knowledge that you have so that you can express it and access it quickly. And again, that happens during sleep. And I think many of us have had this experience of being able to pull something up during sleep, whether it's something from memory or something that you've just a problem that you're trying to solve, and being able to do it after sleep, but not being able to do it before. So you're missing out on all those benefits. And then on top of it, sleep deprivation just wipes out the prefrontal cortex, wipes out the hippocampus, and you're under stress because you're sleep deprived, and all that stuff's terrible for memory.
I find the topic of memory fascinating for so many reasons. There's no classes on how to focus, concentrate. It's like going to a child and say, study this or remember this is like going to somebody saying, play the ukulele or the didgeridoo, who's never had any kind of training on how to actually do that. I know people are going to want to know this question because we opened with it. So in your estimation then, and based on your research and study, why do people forget things and what can we do to remember them better besides getting your book, my book, those kind of things, which I encourage.
Remember to buy your books.
Yes.
No. There's many different things. I'll just give you a few. So, the why we forget part, there's two big basic factors. So one is the information might not be biologically important. The things that we remember tend to be the ones that are biologically important. What I mean by that is they tend to be the things that evoke our emotions, so things that give us a sense of desire or happiness or attachment, things that scare us, things that where we're stressed, for instance. All these factors can promote plasticity in the brain and help a memory stick around. Then there's the things that are surprising, places that we go that are brand new where there's a lot of plasticity taking place. And as I mentioned, just the act of pulling up a memory can induce some plasticity and can make a memory stronger just by virtue of having pulled it up. So next week, if your listeners try to remember this conversation that they're listening to now, they will have a better memory for whatever they're able to pull up. So all these factors can help a memory stick around. But why do we forget? A big part of why we forget is that memory is competitive. It's not like, you know, if I put something on my phone, like a bunch of photos, as long as there's space, the photos don't compete with each other, right? But in my brain, they do. And that's part of the enormous economy of the way the human brain is. So two memories of you putting your keys in different places in the house will compete with each other. And if you go to the things that we forget the most, they tend to be the things where they're very competitive, like remembering where you put your keys or remembering names, right? So your name is Jim and Jim has a unique memory, association with your face, but I've met other people named Jim. So that word is not a cue that's uniquely tied to your face, right? And so what happens is there's a competition. When I see your face, I might be trying to access your name, but that name is associated with many other faces. Now, on top of it, there's no obvious relationship between the name Jim and your face, right?
Right.
You could very easily be named Alex or, David.
Back then, some time in history ago, people were named Baker if they were maybe a baker. That was a profession. Or Taylor, and so on. Or Smith, maybe they were blacksmith. Uh-huh. But certainly, we don't have those the same associations today.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is that if I were to meet you and you were to tell me you were a baker, normally giving you more information to memorize makes it harder to remember any of those things. Mm-hmm. But if I learn about you and you tell me you're a baker and you tell me where you live and so forth, now I have all this meaning around you. And that, again, makes it easier to remember your name. So if you pull up one feature, what happens is you get all the others for free if they're all integrated. Mm-hmm. The two key characteristics to remembering better are integration and distinctiveness. And so what I mean by that is, if I'm trying to find a post-it note on my, table, one way to do it is to actually have that particular post-it note be a unique color. If I have a bunch of yellow post-it notes on my table, they're all going to look alike. There's too much competition. I'll never find the one I'm looking for. So having a pink one will really help relative to the yellow one. But now let's say I also sort my post-it notes in different pile where I go, here's my passwords, here's phone numbers that I'm writing down. Here's email addresses. I realize nobody does this anymore, but if you were and you organized it, that's even better, right? Because now every like note has a particular place to go to. And so that's where, I mean, basically most of the strategies that you teach people for mnemonics focus on distinctiveness and organization.
There's certain definitely principles to better recall. When you mentioned feelings in the book, you'd mentioned feelings and the five primary senses to access a memory. But you also mentioned music could potentially be an incredible, a powerful enabling tool, a supportive tool in this process. What is the link between music and memory?
Do you have too much to read, but too little time? Are your shelves full of books that you haven't read yet and become shelf help, not self-help? And that's why I created the Quick Reading Course. 15 minutes a day, 21 days will absolutely transform your life. Just go to quickbrain.com/reading. Use the code podcast15 and you'll get instant access.
Yeah, if you think about it, it goes all the way back to the Iliad and the Odyssey and Mahabharata and the Ramayana in my culture. Mm-hmm. It's these, this is how people would memorize huge amounts of information, is they would make them into song, they make them into, poetic meter. And so that's how they would be able to orally transmit so much information. And I think song has a bunch of characteristics. So there's just for singular events, let's say, music can pull up a memory that seemed dormant because we often listen to music during particular times in our life. Let's say you broke up from a partner or something like that, and you spent your summer listening to the Smiths or something. Right. You're wallowing in your depression or whatever. And that music now, later on, will bring you back to that particular time and place because the music is kind of this background context that pulls you in. Now, music is also effective because it brings out arousal often, it brings out energy, it evokes emotion. And again, all those factors bring up a unique mental context, but also can, and under the right circumstances, enhance plasticity as well. So then there's another part of it, which is music acts as a kind of a structure. So people in the memorization field love to talk about the memory palace or the method of loci, where you take like a house and you sort of put things that you have to memorize, like people's names or something, in individual rooms in a house, and you mentally walk through. Well, for people who don't have a good mental imagery ability, music is just as good of a structure. Yeah. So there's a school of thought that says memory is somehow uniquely associated with space. And I don't believe that. I think music is a beautiful structure, at least for humans as well.
It's similar to like, I challenge anyone listening to say the letters of the alphabet without actually singing the melody, because it's so ingrained in how it's installed. It's kind of like information by itself is very forgettable, but information when it's tied to those feelings become unforgettable. Like you mentioned, you could hear a few notes for a song on the radio and it could take you back to when you're a teenager. Or if it's not a sound, it could be a food or a fragrance that could, mm-hmm. you taste or smell, and it could take you back to when you're a child. Mm-hmm. And so we know olfactory is very powerful connection also to memory. Mm-hmm. And so this is fascinating because I could talk to you for a long time about creativity and memory. Maybe we could save that for a future episode. I want to thank you so much for being on our show. I want to recommend everybody gets their copy of Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Where can people stay in touch with you or get the book or social media websites?
Yeah. So if you want to get on my mailing list, you can go to charanranganath.com. You could also go to the Memory Doc on Instagram, where I post about events and I post content about how to improve memory. And I also am on Twitter. They can follow me at charanranganath there.
This is amazing. We'll put all of these listed on our show notes, as we always do, at jimquick.com/notes, link to the book, to his website, to his social media, and a lot more. And I just want to remind everyone that just having great memory is not just about memorizing facts and figures and formulas. A lot of it is about remembering the times that you laughed, the times that you loved, the things that you learned in life, and the life we live are the lessons that we teach. So live an unforgettable life. I want to thank you again so much for being on our show. And it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. And it's been great to share all this information with your listeners.
More to come, everybody. Make sure you leave a review and subscribe. We put the extended version of this episode, which is a lot more than 20 minutes, on our YouTube. Make sure you join our 1.5 million subscribers there. Ask your questions there. And until our next episode, remember to be limitless. Bye, everyone.